Thank you for attending 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, Session 312. Thank you. Titled First and Second Vision Stories, Development, History, and Magic. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. Please type your questions into the Whova app to be addressed during the Q&A session at the end. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, the first paper will present the historical background to the earliest and most complete written accounts of the first vision of Joseph Smith. The three most important descriptions were provided in 1832, 1835, and 1839, and all have different backgrounds and emphasis. Early developments came in 1835 when theological changes were being made in the church. The most detailed telling was made during a period of persecution. In the second paper, the Smith family magic practices are well attested, but the relationship between obtaining plates of gold from a messenger and Joseph Smith's practice of magic remains unclear. Did Joseph Smith's use of an 1801 book on ceremonial magic assist him in his quest for gold plates? I look at Francis Barrett's Magus, and parallels to Lucy's account of her son's attempts to obtain the plates, including his encounters with good and evil beings, magic circles, the deity Abrac, and more. What can be learned from Lucy Maximus' reminiscences and the instructions on ceremonial magic from the Magus? I'll take just a second to introduce you to our speakers before we begin. H. Michael Marquardt is the compiler of Early Patriarchal Blessings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Smith Pettit Foundation, 2007. Later Patriarchal Blessings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Smith Pettit Foundation, 2012, and co-author with William Shepherd of Lost Apostles, Forgotten Members of Mormonism's Original Quorum of 12, Signature Books, 2014. Claire Barris has published in the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal and the Journal of Mormon History, has been a guest on several Mormon history podcasts, has presented papers at various conferences, and manages todayinmormonhistory.com. Yeah. And now I'll give the floor to our presenters.
Soon after the Joseph Smith Sr. family arrived in Palmyra, Ontario County, New York, young Joseph Jr. studied the Bible. He had an interest in biblical themes. In 1832, Joseph Smith told about the year 1817 or 1818. At about the age of 12 years, my mind became seriously impressed with regard to the all-important concerns for the welfare of my immortal soul, which led me to searching the scriptures. Joseph was also acquainted with different Protestant denominations. He attended a debating club and was a lay exhorter in a Methodist class. When his father had a disagreement with Jeremiah Herbert, Joseph, 13 years old, testified in the court trial. He attended school off and on and worked to help support his family. Joseph Smith may have had many first visions, as the background to his recollections are different in each case. On April 6, 1830, at Manchester, New York, a revelation was given to keep a record. Oliver Cowdery kept a history, followed by John Whitmer. The Cowdery history is not extant, but he later wrote a series of letters that covered early events before the church was established. The letters covered the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Church missionaries preached about an angel revealing to Joseph Smith locational plates of gold. The end result was the publication of the Book of Mormon in Palmyra, New York, in March 1830. Joseph Smith in his youth worked as a treasure seer by showing money diggers where there were treasures to be located in the ground and hills. This took place in the township of Manchester, southern New York, and northern Pennsylvania. This was considered questionable because money would be obtained with a promise of success. Sometime the lookers would have to leave the area and never obtain any treasure except what they may have received from those interested in such adventures. From the historical record relating to a March 20th, 1826 court examination or trial, it was evident that Joseph Smith was found guilty by not actually locating any treasure. He needed to turn his life around. The Articles and Covenants of the Church of Christ mentions the first elder, Joseph Smith, receiving forgiveness and his Book of Mormon calling. For after it was truly manifest unto this first elder that he had received a remission of his sins, he was again entangled in the vanities of the world. But after truly repenting, God ministered unto him by an holy angel whose countenance was as lightning, and gave unto him power by the means which were before prepared that he should translate a book. In 1831, John Whitmer was appointed to write and keep a history of a new church. He did not write in his history book until later. In 1838, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon wrote to Whitmer asking for the record. When Whitmer refused, they wrote their own history. Joseph Smith produced an early history of his life and the rise of a church in 1832. It was not until about 1965 that this story started becoming known. The account starts with a foreword given background in certain events in the life of the young prophet. In January 1832, Smith was ordained president of the high priesthood. In this role, he dictated and recorded his early history. Smith told about searching the scriptures years earlier. He concluded that the different denominations did not live by a holy walk. He wrote in his own hand, "From the age of 12 years to 15, I pondered many things in my heart concerning the situations of the world of mankind, the contentions and divisions, the wickedness and abominations, and the darkness which prevailed the minds of mankind. My mind became exceedingly distressed, for I became convicted of my sins, and by searching the scriptures, I found that mankind did not come unto the Lord, but they had apostatized from the true and living faith, and there was no society or denomination that built upon the gospel of Jesus Christ as recorded in the New Testament, and I felt to mourn for my own sins and for the sins of the world." He went into a wilderness and prayed. He said that he had a heavenly vision and saw the Lord and heard the following words, "Joseph, my son, thy sins are forgiven thee. Go thy way, walk in my statutes and keep my commandments. Behold, I am the Lord of glory. I was crucified for the world, that all those who believe on my name may have eternal life. Behold, the world lieth in sin at this time, and none doeth good, no, not one. They have turned aside from the gospel and kept not my commandments. They draw near to me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me. And my anger is kindled against the inhabitants of the earth to visit them according to their ungodliness and to bring to pass that which had been spoken by the mouths of prophets and apostles. Behold, and lo, I come quickly, as it is written of me in the cloud, clothed in the glory of my Father. Though a few words are common in the histories, this writing was not known to be used for his later manuscript history. Besides copies of early revelations, the 1832 history is the earliest known history written in part by Joseph Smith. While living in Kirkland, Ohio, Oliver Cowdery wrote a series of letters that were to cover the history of the rise and progress of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. Cowdery evidently obtained his information from Joseph himself, and he wrote about a great awakening and Methodist elder George Lane, who had visited the Palmyra area. But rather than placing the ministry in the latter part of 1824, as Lane had done, Cowdery's 1834 letter placed it in 1820 or 1821. As Cowdery told the story, it was in the 15th year of Joseph Smith's life. One Mr. Lane, a presiding elder of the Methodist Church, visited Palmyra and vicinity. Elder Lane was a talented man, possessing a good share of literary endowments and apparent humility. There was a great awakening or excitement raised on the subject of religion and much inquiry for the word of life. Large additions were made to the Methodist, Presbyterian, and Baptist churches. Much good instruction was always drawn from his discourses on the scriptures. And in common with others, our brother's mind became awakened. In this general strife for followers, his mother, one sister, and two of his natural brothers were persuaded to unite with the Presbyterians. Cowdery wrote that Joseph's mother united with the Presbyterians, paralleling the event cited in Lucy Smith's own history about joining a church. In his following letter, printed in February 1835, Cowdery made what he termed a correction in the type to Joseph Smith's 17th year, which would have been in 1822. But he mentions the year as 1823 concerning the excitement in Palmyra, but still at variance with the earlier 1820-21 date portrayed in his December letter. Cowdery's statement would now bring new focus to the evening of September 21st, 1823, almost 2 months before Alvin Smith's death. While Cowdery's letters related to Smith's early religious experience, he mentioned only an angel and did not give details of an earlier vision. During 1834-35, theological lectures were given for the elders. The seven theological lectures on faith were included on the first 70 pages of the first edition of the Doctrine and Covenants. They were the doctrine part of the book. This included the fifth lecture on the Godhead. It defined the Godhead as consisting of two personages, the Father and the Son, with the Holy Spirit bearing record of them. The wording of some of the early revelations were modified, and the texts were printed in the Covenants and Commandment part of the Doctrine and Covenants. This includes revelatory texts relating to the work of dictating the words for the Book of Mormon. There was no apparent problem modifying the content of revelations for this new book for the regulation of the church. In telling about the early religious experiences, Joseph Smith expanded and modified his story. Seeing the Lord, as explained in his 1832 recollections, and concerning his vision of an angel revealing the Book of Mormon story, changed. Dropped was the excitement of religion mentioned in Oliver Cowdery's letter prior to answer to his prayer. Added was the idea of seeing two personages following the lectures on theology. The story was his, as he was the individual involved. Even though this was prior to church organization, it was considered part of the rise of a Latter-day Church. Joseph Smith told a man who called himself Joshua the Jewish Minister, but was Robert Matthews, also known as Matthias the Prophet, in a personal interview about his early experiences. The date was November 9, 1835 at Kirkland, Ohio. This telling of a story to a stranger was recorded by Warren Parrish and may have been recorded from notes or personal recollection. The journal recorded that Smith gave Joshua a relation of the circumstances connected with the coming forth of the Book of Mormon as follows. In his recounting his youth, Smith said, "I knew not who was right or who was wrong. I retired to the silent grove and bowed down before the Lord under a realizing sense that he had said, 'If the Bible be true, ask and you shall receive, knock and it shall be opened, seek and you shall find. And again, if any man lacked wisdom, let him ask of God, who giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not.' I called on the Lord in mighty prayer. A pillar of fire appeared above my head. It presently rested down upon me and filled me with joy unspeakable. A personage appeared in the midst of this pillar of flame, which was spread all around, and it nothing consumed. Another personage soon appeared, like unto the first. He said unto me, 'Thy sins are forgiven thee.' He testified unto me that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And I saw many angels in this vision. I was about 14 years old when I received this first communication. When I was about 17 years old, I saw another vision of angels in the night season." The remarks of Joseph Smith to this visitor were recorded in his journal as follows. But later, in 1843, it was edited out, and in its place were put the words, "as recorded in the former part of this history." A few days afterwards, on November 14th, Erastus Holmes visited Joseph Smith, and he told his background. "Up to the time I received the first visitation of angels, which was when I was about 14 years old. Before 1838 and the expulsion from Missouri, it was preached that the Book of Mormon story was the founding event of the Restoration. With his counselor, Sidney Rigdon, and clerk, George W. Robinson, Smith spent a number of days writing his own history, since John Whitmer would not turn over his history. Over a four-day period, they worked on it. The 1838 draft is not extant. The next year, 1839, James Maholin, another scribe, copied the 1838 writing into what is known as the Manuscript History of the Church, Book A1. It seems clear that this account is also a theological endeavor on the part of either Joseph Smith, his counselor Sidney Rigdon, his scribe George W. Robinson, or a combination of the three men. The account that follows is not the last account that Joseph Smith mentioned to others, but it is the longest and most detailed account. This first vision account mentions his vision in the words, "When the light rested upon me, I saw two personages." Since one of the two personages spoke the words, "This is my beloved son, hear him," this has been interpreted that the two personages in the vision were God the Father and his son, Jesus Christ. In this story, the Palmyra revival is placed as a motivating factor prior to the visionary experience. The account mentions that the revival, and unusual excitement on the subject of religion took place in the second year after his father's move to Manchester Township. That happened about 1822. This would place the excitement on religion about 1824. The dating of the first vision to the spring of 1820. It is not to the time of the Palmyre revival. These two events should not have been put together in the story as they appear. They were two events separated by a number of years. Book A1 was revised before and after its publication and is now considered to be Smith's official narrative. An important feature was contained in parentheses, where it stated, "For at this time it had never entered into my heart that all were wrong." The story incorporates an account of Smith's early religious calling and has served as the basis for virtually all official and semi-official histories of the Restoration. The following extracts are from the manuscript history written in 1839 by Mulholland. "Sometime in the second year after our removal to Manchester, there was in the place where we lived an unusual excitement on the subject of religion. I attended their several meetings as occasion would permit, but in the process of time, my mind became somewhat partial to the Methodist sect. I saw a pillar of light. When a light rested upon me, I saw two personages whose brightness and glory defied all description, standing above me in the air. One of them spake unto me, calling me my name, and said, pointing to the other, 'This is my beloved son, hear him.' I asked the personages who stood above me in the light, which of all the sects was right? For at this time it had never entered into my heart that all were wrong, and which I should join. I was answered that I must join none of them, for they were all wrong. And the persons who addressed me said that all their creeds were an abomination in his sight, that those professors were all corrupt, that they draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They teach for doctrines the commandments of men, having a form of godliness, but they deny the power thereof." The Palmyre 1824-25 revival appears to have been an important event for Joseph Smith. It was after his brother Alvin died. It was also the time when family members joined the Western Presbyterian Church of Palmyra. Though Smith may have had a religious experience of forgiveness of sins, it did not have a lasting effect upon him. His visions of Jesus and angels did not show a change in his activities. His earliest story mentioned outside of the family was told to close associates by Joseph Jr. and Joseph Sr. It included elements related to the forthcoming Book of Mormon. The first publication of the first vision appeared in a pamphlet by Church Apostle Orson Pratt. He wrote that Joseph Smith was enwrapped in a heavenly vision and saw two glorious personages who exactly resembled each other in their features or likeness. He was informed that his sins were forgiven. Joseph Smith's accounts evolved over time. The story in his first history was receiving a personal forgiveness and angel vision as his call to prophetic ministry. From having a heavenly vision of Jesus to seeing two separate individuals, one appearing, then another, to the appearing together of two personages. The earlier 1832 history was cut out of the manuscript record, and the 1835 story was edited out, leaving the 1839 history as a theological writing by Smith. By introducing the Palmyre revival in Oliver Cowdery's letter and in the 1839 history when his mother Lucy and other family members joined the local Presbyterian church, creates a chronological and historical problem. The latest history is more theological than history, creating reasons why Joseph did not join any church at the time. The message, as it was written, was that he was told that the local churches were an abomination and not to join any of them. The big issue now became that he was totally persecuted for telling about the vision he received. At the time, Latter-day Saints were experiencing persecution both in Missouri and Ohio. While Joseph Smith's vision could explain why he was not a church member, it does not make sense for family members joining the Presbyterian Church. Many of the same Christian teachings of the local churches are contained in the church's 1830 Articles and Covenants. The first vision was not part of the early Restoration message. Early missionaries were only knew about the angel and the Book of Mormon. Church members were not to put their trust in Joseph Smith's personal experiences. Smith made mistakes, which is why there are different expressions of the Restoration. That's why there is more than one way to be Mormon. Thank you.
That was great, Mike. All right, let's talk about Lucy Mack Smith's reminiscences of folk magic. Lucy Mack Smith's initial draft of her manuscript has a puzzling reference. She warns that readers might assume that her subsequent discussion, which was about Joseph Smith trying to obtain the plates, might lead readers to assume that the Smiths had spent all their time, quote, trying to win the faculty of Abrac, drawing magic circles, or soothsaying, close quote. But she insists that they did not neglect their business and were upright Christians. Lucy, unfortunately, does not pursue this topic further, and the text is dropped in subsequent drafts. It raises several questions. What kind of magical practices did the Smiths engage in? How were magic circles used? What is winning the faculty of Abrac? What historical context can shed light on Lucy's statement? Hopefully we'll answer some of these questions. Regarding her phrase, the faculty of Abrac, it is important to distinguish between two related terms, when they came into use and how they were used. Those terms are faculty of Abrac and the word Abrac all by itself. For our purposes today, I will look only at the second term, the standalone word Abrac, which we find in magic sources. Although elsewhere, I explore the full phrase faculty of Abrac, which has a completely different history and use. Okay, let's talk a little bit about treasure seeking that it started in about 1816 and went in well into the 1820s. Treasure seekers, including the Smiths, the Smith family, used magic circles, implements, and rituals to attempt to summon and then control spirits that had power over buried treasure. Neighbor William Stafford described the Smiths drawing a circle, adding witch hazel sticks around the periphery to keep out evil spirits from the circle, and a second inner circle was drawn and traversed by Joseph Smith Sr. three times, while he uttered unintelligible words, which may have been magic incantations. Then a steel rod was placed at the center of the circle. In his seer stone, Joseph Smith Jr. watched an evil spirit sink the treasure out of their reach due to a mistake in the ritual. This recollection by neighbor Stafford is one of at least 73 accounts of the Smiths' involvement in folk magic. The Smith family probably owned and used magic instruments. When Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram were murdered, they left behind several artifacts. Joseph Smith was carrying a Jupiter talisman, a tool for protection and empowerment, and sometimes used to conjure spirits. Hiram left behind items that he had probably received from Joseph Smith Sr., including a symbol-inscribed dagger, the kind used to draw magic circles during ceremonies to control spirits, including during treasure quests. His effects also included three laymans or magic parchments, each inscribed with specific formula of magic words and symbols. Laymans are used in ceremonial magic for protection, purification, to summon, control, and communicate with spirits. The array of magic symbols and wording on the laymans and dagger were not available in any single published source, but were derived specifically from three books on ceremonial magic. And here's a tracing of one of the laymans used by the Smiths, and I'll show some images a little bit later of that. Of the three books that Smith derived, that these laymans and dagger and talisman were source material for, the one called the Magus is the only printed source for Joseph Smith's Jupiter talisman. It also includes the Intelligence of Mars and Seal of Mars symbols, which are found on the Smith family dagger. Additionally, the Magus includes a 12-pointed Raphael star, a tetragrammaton symbol, and items also found on the Smith family laymans. And matching Lucy Mack Smith's text, the Magus also describes use of magic circles and calling upon Abrac from within that circle to summon spirits. For these reasons, it is important to take the Magus seriously as a possible source of information for Joseph Smith. And here is the text of Lucy Mack Smith's manuscript. And you can see underlined there where, you know, it has the faculty of Abrac drawing magic circles and soothsaying as part of the text of her first manuscript for her family memoir. This is what is called an abracadabra magic triangle. This is out of Cornelius Agrippa's fourth book of occult philosophy. As you can see, the word abracadabra is across the top. And as you descend down, you take away one letter from the word until you get down to the bottom. People would wear this triangle around their necks and repeat this kind of charm or incantation. And when they had a fever, and as the word diminished, so was the fever supposed to diminish as they read this. And it was a common attempt at curing fever. You can see the seventh line down, and seven is an important number. You have the word Abrac, and that's where the word Abrac comes from. These are images of Joseph Smith's Jupiter talisman. You can see this is the Jupiter symbol here. There's some Latin around here that translated says something like, make me, O God, all-powerful. Here is a magic square with Hebrew numbers, the number 136, which the numbers add up to. There's the Jupiter symbol again. This is an image of the dagger that was left behind by Hiram Smith when he passed away. You can see the Intelligence of Mars symbol there, and you can see some Hebrew there. These are the laymans that were left behind by the Smiths. And here's a close-up of the one of the three laymans called the Holiness to the Lord layman. There's a lot of symbols there, but here's a Raphael 12-pointed star. Here's a tetragrammaton symbol, and there's a lot of other symbolism on here, and it's a fascinating thing to look at. Okay, I'm going to go back and continue on. All right, let's talk about the book The Magus and the practice of spirit conjuration. The Abrac magic circle summoning ritual included in The Magus can be traced back to the 14th century. The magician is instructed to consult the astrological formula to determine when to attempt to conjure the spirit, and the magician or exorcist begins steps of purification 9 days before constructing the circle. Note that the 14th century version of the ritual calls the magician a priest, while Barrett's 1801 The Magus calls the magician an exorcist. The magician inscribes the sword with specific names and symbols and consecrates it for use in preparing the circle. A layman, that is the magic parchment, is also prepared for conjuration with specific names of angels that preside over the spirits that are to be controlled. 3 days before the appointed time, the conjurer fasts and abstains from sexual activity, and on the day of the ritual dresses in white linen, and at the appointed time draws a circle with the sword and consecrates the circle. The magician places perfumes in the fire and offers a prayer to prevent false imaginations or hallucinations from the spirits, and completes the circle and invokes the angels from the four parts of the world, which are represented in the four parts of the circle. This binds the spirits to give correct answers and to do what the magician commands of them. Other orations are offered and the spirits appear, but when they appear, they produce, quote, infinite visions, apparitions, phantasms, that with terror they might force some of the exorcist's companions from the circle, close quote. Some of these apparitions, quote, appear as horrible beasts which will arrange themselves as if they would devour the companions, close quote. The exorcist then produces the layman and compels them to obey, and the terrifying visions disappear, but give way to hissings from the four parts of the world, along with, quote, great motions, close quote. Some of the apparitions appear as horrible beasts, which will arrange themselves as if they would devour the companions. The exorcist produces the layman and compels him to obey, and the terrifying visions finally disappear, but give way to the hissings from the four parts of the world with great motions. So holding the layman then at this point, the magician declares, quote, prepare yourselves to be obedient to your master. In the name of the Lord Bathot Vachot, rushing upon Abrac, there's that word that Lucy wrote, Abor coming upon Abrer. At this point, the spirits transform into human-like forms, and the spirits are now completely obedient to the exorcist, who asks, and the spirits ask to do their bidding. Note that the magician's objective occurs when the spirits are controlled by calling upon entities, including Abrac, while holding the uncovered layman. So this is the cover page of the book, The Magus, that we've been talking about, where this ritual that we just went over is described. This is the section that describes and as you can see, it focuses on magic circles. And this is an illustration in that section. You can see here is a magic circle. You can see there's multiple circles in there. You can see the four parts of the world symbolized by those four quarters. Here is a tetragrammaton layman. Here's a Raphael, a 12-pointed star. And both of these, we saw tetragrammaton symbols, a Raphael star in the Smith family layman's. Here's the sword that is used to draw the magic circle. So this kind of gives you a sense of what's in the magus and this illustration. Okay, let's talk about Joseph Smith now. Joseph Smith's encounter with supernatural beings. The book from which the Smith family magic symbolisms draw describe a world of good and evil, angels and spirits. Difficulties the exorcist must overcome from the spirits being summoned include false imaginations, invoking terror, forcing individuals from the protection of the circle, hissings, great motions, images of wild beasts, fear of being devoured, terrible visions, false imaginations, etc. It's a pretty bad experience. The number of items from the ritual just described from the magus seem to have parallels with Joseph Smith's attempt to obtain the buried plates. After Lucy Mack Smith mentions abrac and magic circles, she describes encounters with one or more beings that may fit within the magus conjuring ritual context. Joseph was given specific instructions on how to proceed to obtain the plates, including wearing black clothing, bringing specific individuals with him, making the attempt at an astrologically significant time, using a black horse, and demanding the book by a specific name. Unsuccessful treasure quests were usually blamed on a mistake during the ritual. Lucy Mack Smith points out that, quote, the personage, close quote, told Joseph, quote, I will show you the difference between light and darkness and the operations of a good spirit and an evil one. An evil spirit will try to crowd your mind with every evil and wicked thing to keep every good thought and feeling from your mind, close quote. The angel further warned that, quote, when you go to get the plates, your mind will be filled with darkness and all manner of evil will rush into your mind, close quote. Okay, let's talk about the 1822 visit. Immediately after Lucy's mention of magic circles and winning the faculty of abrac, she described Joseph Smith's first encounter with an angel of the Lord that appeared in his room during harvest time, probably in the fall of 1822, according to Lucy's time frame. The magus states the magician is to purify his or herself, including abstaining from sexual activity. Joseph said he prayed for and received forgiveness for his sins at his first encounter with the messenger. Those sins included, quote, diverse temptations to the gratifications of many appetites, offensive in the sight of God, close quote. After taking steps to prove that a conjured spirit is good, the magus suggests asking what times are most agreeable to hold conference with the angel. Lucy wrote that before the September 1823 visit, the angel gave a specific date to obtain the plates. The same date is specified again for 1827, and perhaps the years in between. We don't have a record of that. That the fall equinox was specified is particularly significant from a magic frame of reference. Okay, let's talk about 1823. In 1823, after setting the plates aside, Joseph Smith was hurled back by the messenger, leaving him senseless or unconscious. Quote, when he recovered, the angel was gone and the plates had disappeared and reappeared, leaving him, quote, much alarmed, close quote. Lucy interpreted this as, quote, the insinuations and power of the adversary, close quote. The family prayed that, quote, Joseph might be more fully instructed and preserved from all the wiles and machinations of him who lieth in wait to deceive, close quote. Clearly, Lucy's earliest interpretation of Joseph Smith's attempt to obtain the plates has him interacting with a hostile or uncontrolled or evil spirit, angel, devil, or messenger. Smith's own account suggests the violent attack was, quote, by the power of the adversary, close quote, not by an angel. Smith's primary violation appears to be that he temporarily set down the plates, bringing to mind the perfection required during money digging rituals. Oliver Cowdery describes the angel as delivering three shocks and that Joseph wondered if the plates had, quote, an enchantment, close quote, on them. Lucy said Joseph's attempt left the family, quote, disturbed, close quote. Many treasure seekers believe the devil could summon ghosts or spirits to obstruct their efforts, or that he could transform himself into any number of frightening animals. This matches the description that he could transform that of uncontrolled spirits in the Magus as they try to force individuals from the protection of the magic circle. Willard Chase and Benjamin Saunders recounted that Joseph Smith saw something like a toad with the plates that, quote, soon assumed the appearance of a man and struck him on the side of the head, close quote. Saunders' nephew Orson recalled Lorenzo elaborating about the toad, quote, the beast arose and expanded as large as a dog, then as a bullock, and then it rose far above me, a flaming monster with glittering eyes, until it seemed to fill the heavens with a blow like lightning that swept me from the mountains into the valley beneath. After regaining his senses, Smith reached for the plates. Quote, the moment I touched them, 1,000 devils sprang into light, and they were all around the hill. The mountain seemed alive with them, close quote. This account seems to convey the state of uncontrolled spirits doing their best to force the exorcist from the protective magic circle. Joseph said he was in a dreamlike state and that the experience left him, quote, exceedingly frightened, close quote. All right, let's talk about 1827. The Magus indicates that a magician should ritually dress in white linen clothing, while another book that was the source of some of the Smith's laymans specifies white or black linen. Multiple associates point out that according to the angel's instructions, Joseph rode a black horse or black clothing and demanded the book, quote, in a certain name, close quote, at the time specified by the angel. As detailed in the Magus and other texts, some objects, including magic books, should be wrapped in linen. Joseph wrapped the plates in his linen frock after obtaining them, and he kept them under a linen tablecloth at his home. All right, let's summarize. As mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, this is one of two interpretations I advanced regarding the term abrac. The proposition of Joseph Smith's attempt to obtain plates, taking into account Lucy Smith's mention of abrac, magic circles, adversarial encounters, requirements that appear to be from the context of treasure seeking, Smith's family parchments, daggers, talismans, and other descriptions of Joseph to obtain the plate, is to place the attempts to obtain the plates in the context described in the Magus. The scenario would go something like this. So this is a scenario, a possibility. After fasting, praying for purification, and dressing in ritual clothing, Joseph drew a magic circle with the inscribed and consecrated Smith family dagger around the location of the plates which he had discerned with his seer stone. There he attempted to conjure a spirit charged with protecting the plates with incantations in one of the Smith family laymans. Before he was able to uncover the layman and call upon the deities, including Abrac, to fully subject the spirit to his complete control, he made a mistake and the spirit hurled him from the protective magic circle, knocking him unconscious, preventing him from taking control and commanding the spirit to deliver the plates. After additional yearly attempts and additional requirements by the messenger, in 1827, Joseph was able to satisfy the messenger's requirement and enacted the ritual without fault, calling upon Abrac with the layman in hand, successfully taking control of the spirit and demanding the gold plates by the name specified by the angel. It seems probable that more than one supernatural entity was involved, perhaps an angel directing Smith how to obtain plates from a guarding spirit, or perhaps the angel sometimes being in subjection to Smith and at other times uncontrolled. Or perhaps a good angel with one or more evil angels, devils, or spirits trying to thwart the objective of Joseph Smith and the good angel. Here we see how the standalone term abrac is used in ceremonial magic and how it may have been used by Joseph Smith. Magic is an integral component of Joseph Smith's migration to prophethood and may fit within Lucy Mack Smith's reference to abrac in magic circles when referencing her son as he transitioned from a practitioner of magic to prophethood. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you so much for both of those. We have a number of questions from the participants, and we have about 7 minutes left, so I'll just take them in order, and I'll let you know when we're out of time.
Right.
The first question is, do you think that Lucy had more to do with the production of the Book of Mormon than we know? Yesterday, in the presentation about Native myths, etc., one of the presenters spoke of Native, and excuse me, this is a long question, so I have to jump in. Spoke of Native women interpreting the dreams, which were not treated as the truth, but they were skeptical.
That's the question?
That's the question. The basic question is, do you think Lucy had more to do with the production of the Book of Mormon than we know?
Not that I am aware of. I don't know, Mike, if you...
Well, Lucy Smith had dreams, visions, just like Mother Rockwell. And that was mentioned, years later.
So it's always possible, as Lucy Smith is, dictating her history. She's telling about the family's involvement in the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. So this is an area that definitely more research should be done in.
Great. Okay. Thank you. The next question is, do you think that the Book of Mormon might contain earlier accounts of the first vision hidden allegorically throughout the text?
Well, there's a little mention about forgiveness of sins and a vision, but it's hard to say since Smith had a number of visions, especially he was in 1835 telling visitors about seeing many angels, almost overshadowing, seeing one and then another. So it could be, but there's not that much information. The articles in Covenants of the Church mentioned that he received the forgiveness of sins, and that could be another mention. But the 1832 account is the earliest one. It's written in the handwriting of Frederick G. Williams, his scribe, and also in Joseph Smith's own hand. So it's very early, even though it's over 10 years later. It was, retained by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but not readily available to historians such as B.H. Roberts.
I've kind of wondered if some of the visionary accounts, like Lehi's vision, I think that's a great question. And I think just maybe Joseph Smith is reflecting on his experience. I don't know. I think that's worth looking at and at least pondering, as it might be some reflection of Joseph's experience.
Excellent. Okay, next question. And this one is directed specifically at you, Mike. How does the 1832 vision account compare to the modern DNC 20 version? And which of the two was actually written first? And so this kind of follows up the previous question.
Well, the 1832 account is the earliest one we know of. We probably wouldn't have known about it until, Paul Chessman had it in his thesis in 1965. So it was written, it was cut out of a letter book. So that's the earliest. And if we didn't know about that, we know one thing for certain, what the early missionaries were preaching. And that is about the angel in the book. They didn't preach about Joseph Smith's personal experience. And if he had a forgiveness of sin, but he went back into the same activities before his experience. So that is, you know, an important item to reconcile and to realize that the family, you know, they mother joined the Presbyterian Church, and his sister, Sophronia, joined, and Hiram and Samuel. So it was certainly different than what you would think reading the 1838 account. But certainly in the 1838 account, Joseph does mention the members of his family by name who joined the local Presbyterian Church.
We are just about out of time, but I think we can squeeze in this one last question. This one is directed at Claire. Do you think Joseph's mistakes in the various expressions of the first vision could be attributed to his evolving skills as a storyteller?
So I'm guessing they're talking about the second vision or the Moroni encounters. And I don't know about a lot of what I drew on was from Lucy Mack Smith's reminiscence. I did supplement a bit from Joseph Smith. I think that he's trying to tell, unfortunately, I wish we had more detail about what happened. We have to do a lot of conjecturing from the other accounts of magic that are going on and the items he had at hand. But Lucy gives some hints. The Magus, I think, might be detailing the ritual that was used in treasure seeking that may have been applied to obtaining the plates. And Joseph's evolving storytelling, certainly the story evolves past this time, and it's really hard to tell exactly how, but Joseph really wanted to downplay any role of magic, and that occurs, I think, primarily after 1834, when Philastus Hurlbut and Heber D. House, the affidavits and book in the book called Mormonism Unveiled come out. And that embarrasses Joseph Smith because it reveals a lot of the treasure-seeking stories that occurred. And from that point on, Joseph Smith, I believe, really wants to downplay that. And any stories or references to magic get significantly downplayed from that point on. So I think there's an evolution of the story after the fact, but Lucy gives us a great snapshot into what happened, I think, and helps us determine more what occurred at that point in time.
Thank you both so much for your presentations today. And thanks everybody in the audience for joining us. We are out of time, but we can continue this discussion on the community chat boards. And I wish you all a very happy rest of a symposium. Thanks, gentlemen.